Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Women Emerging podcast. I'm Julian Middleton, founder of Women Emerging and your podcast host. Every Wednesday, I explore how women lead differently. Over time, all of us who are part of Women Emerging are determined to redefine leading so that more of us can say, if that's leading, I'm in. Happy New Year. Happy, happy New Year. Happy 2025. Think back. 2024, we were told it was going to be the year of elections. Now I suppose 2025 is the fallout from the year of elections. 2024 was also, of course, a year of wars and genocides, and a year when COP was in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, a country where one of my dearest of friends, Ruben, has been imprisoned now for over a year for being really just a very, very good human being and man who stood up. So I hope 2024-5 is going to be better. But surely it's a year when all of us as women know that we need to lead even more than we ever have, because we've got to bring people together. 2024 for Women Emerging, of course, was a beautiful year when we laid really our foundations. We put in our roots so that we're ready to really flourish in 2025. So 2025 seems a bit special to me, full of hope, full of energy. Yes, energy. So happy New Year. We're starting 2025 with a series of episodes about how women lead in hostile environments, because we so often do lead in hostile environments. We're going to talk about fear and courage, and what brings out the best in all of us in amongst this hostility. And we're going to start by talking to Amina, an utterly remarkable woman who leads something called She Her, is based in Lahore in Pakistan. She's a lawyer who works to uphold human rights of marginalized communities in Pakistan. So she is very much surrounded by hostility. Over to you, Amina. Amina, hostile environments. We've got to talk to you about hostile environments. Now, tell me firstly why you think it is a hostile environment.
So the work I do is human rights litigation, which means that it's human rights cases in court in Pakistan. So the general context is that the field is extremely male-dominated. You see very few female lawyers. And then within the human rights space, you see, I think, probably barely a handful of female lawyers. So the acceptability towards allowing women into the space and giving them space is low. The tolerance towards accepting that a woman might have something of value to say is also low. So generally, I feel like there's a lot of resistance towards ceding space for women in environments that are very male-dominated. And then even when a woman ends up taking the space, like let's say myself or the team of women that work with me, I think we face a lot of patronizing comments. Just right now, somebody was asking me what people refer to me as in court. And he was asking me if they refer to me as madam. And I was telling him how sometimes they even refer to me as baby because they want me to move away, which is quite funny. Actually, not very funny, but in the moment, it makes you very angry. But it just goes to show
you. Hang on. I've got to interrupt you. Baby. What? So how does the sentence go?
So it's kind of like they don't mean baby as in a romantic way. They mean as in a child. So kind of like, you know, you're a small child, go out of the way. So I often then say, actually, no, I'm the opposing counsel in this case, so I cannot move out of the way. So and then they kind of pipe down. But there's a lot of this in the workspace, and that's what makes it hostile.
So when they call you baby, it must feel very hostile. Give me other examples of the manifestation of the hostility.
I mean, there's a lot of staring at you and sort of looking at you to intimidate you till you give up the space. But and then, you know, this is what we kind of were earlier talking about. It ends up making one almost reactive because I stare back to try and kind of, you know, claim my space. And so it's a bit of a turf war, but I also think that men in Pakistan, particularly in Punjab, in the province I'm practicing in, they're not used to seeing women in litigation. So women are often encouraged to do corporate jobs, they're encouraged to take up roles in the judiciary because those roles are more cushioned. The hours are easier. So in the past, I've had bosses saying to me, you know, you could consider being a judge simply because I didn't want to stay in the office every night till 12 a.m. when there wasn't anything to do, or because I finished my work faster than others. So there's a lot of there's small examples of this. And I think now that I have my own organization, I've sort of ended up not focusing on it as much. When I worked under men, it really was the highlight and focus of my day-to-day life. And it was quite consuming then because I was constantly focusing on everything that was said to me that might be sexist or patriarchal. But now that I have my own space to be, I think I'm able to really take it in my stride because at least the culture of where we work is not hostile. The culture of where we work is quite amicable and I think collegiate. But courts, which is where we have to go argue cases, become extremely hostile. There's also this emphasis on the fact that, you know, you're foreign educated. So it's almost as if being foreign educated is a problem. And, you know, this kind of derogatory remarks placed as to, oh, you went, like, where did you go to school? Or you went to school in Cambridge or something silly like that, which shouldn't affect, actually, if anything, hopefully it should improve the quality of my work, if anything, if I've kind of used my education well. But there's a lot of patriarchal, you know, derogatory comments in the day-to-day work environment.
I remember you telling me also that you look younger than you are.
Yeah, that's why baby.
That's why they call you baby.
Yeah. So I think they often think I'm a school student, which is really funny because, you know, what you can't really help how old you look. So oftentimes if I'm sitting in court and preparing for a case outside, like somebody will cross me and say, oh, you remind me of my college days. Like, okay, sure. I don't always have the heart to correct them and tell them I'm not in college. So it's amusing in that sense. And I think they often confuse me because I end up assisting the court as an amicus, which is a legal expert in a case. And an amicus is appointed by the court to provide an unbiased and nuanced opinion on the law after assessing both sides. So you look at the case put forward by the petitioner and the defendant. And often it's on very important laws that are challenged. So when then they find out that I'm a micus, then they get quite alarmed. And, you know, you see a complete change in attitude, an attitude of respect, an attitude of deference. So I think I've gotten quite used to that.
And the danger is that all this makes you, in your leading, hard. Is that right? Hard and sometimes bitter? I'm using your words, not just mine. But I think you did say that, didn't you?
I think more than bitter, aggressive, because I think you end up being responsive or defensive to try and, you know, clarify your position or explain what the reality is. So you end up really having to do a lot of explaining because people are misunderstanding or miscategorizing you. You know, even opposing counsel, they will often make allusions as to, you know, they'll be alluding as to your lack of experience or your, because due to your age. So then that means you have to overcompensate and explain to them, actually, you don't know my age. And either way, I'm still the opposing counsel in the case. So you would have to treat me with the same level of respect you treat your male colleagues. But unfortunately, you don't see that. So, and I think I do often, I've tried to, for the most part, try to minimize my interactions now with male colleagues or opposing parties who I can see that there's definitely a difference of worldview and like opinions on. And I notice that just ends up making me not be defensive. Because then if you end up being defensive and aggressive, then you take that defensiveness and aggressiveness through your day into everything you're doing, including into, you know, if you're trying to run an organization, you become defensive if anybody questions you or if they shed any kind of, you know, not being deferring towards your leadership or your authority. So it seeps in if you don't kind of catch it, I think.
Did you learn that the hard way? Did you see it happening to you and decide to counter it?
Yeah, I definitely saw it happening to me. That's why I kind of started limiting my interactions with men, certain opposing counsels that happen to be men. So I changed my strategy because I noticed I would end up getting very worked up. They often call at night. You know, they want you to come to their office, they won't come to yours. So there's these like small instances of trying to maintain power. So I think I did end up getting quite defensive in the first, I think, 2 to 3 years that I started practicing in my own, with my own organization. Then after that, which was about, I think, maybe 3 to 4 years ago, I started shifting my interactions with men as well as females, actually, and changing the way I'm approaching it. But of course, it's like you're human. Sometimes it's impossible not to get upset if someone is being patronizing. But I think one of the main things that I started to learn, and my grandfather said this to me, is that, you know, just take it with a pinch of salt, like take it with humor. So now I've started to try and laugh it off. And they often find it very rude, but I still make myself laugh about it because that prevents me from getting angry. So I've kind of shifted it to become a more humorous situation.
And that works?
It works for me. It doesn't work for them. I think they get offended. But it works for me because I end up laughing it off, because otherwise it's... If you take your interactions with men in the day, in the legal space, I think there could probably be in every day, maybe 10 to 15 to 20 things that would upset me and antagonize me. There's also a general level of, if you have any males reporting to you, which in the past I did not, because I completely made a share my law firm female, comprised of females, but then I did end up having to add one or two males onto the team to be the counterpart to interacting with those males on the other side that can often be hostile. And I do notice that there is this difference with which I see men approach men as leaders and females as leaders. So that kind of is something. So in the day-to-day, you will see, you know, somebody answer back, or rather than, you know, accepting positive feedback, giving you many reasons for why they didn't do something and how they're doing their best. But in reality, you've seen them work with males and this is not their best. So I think there is a lot of elements that come into play within our social context. It's very unique in Pakistan because it's a very unequal society. There's a huge gender gap.
So there's a danger that you harden in how you lead. And in a way, you've sort of tried to insulate yourself from that and sent other people to do the interactions rather than you, so that you deliberately do not become the sort of devil wears Prada type of person. There's some other words you used, angry. So you would avoid feeling angry if you can, because you, I remember you saying to me that makes you, well, admit, I've written it down, in the moment that you become angry, then you stop leading. Why did you say that?
So to answer the first part of your question of insulating yourself and, you know, not being sort of the devil wears Prada, I think that a characteristic possibly of a good leader is being able to delegate effectively. And so if you understand that there's a structural failing in the system, and the system, irrespective of you kind of grinding that stone, is not going to change. They're still going to patronize you, maybe after they see you in for 15 to 20 years and really you've aged, till then they're going to keep patronizing you. Therefore, dealing with that scenario, it's easier to put in a man in those situations to prevent this kind of daily grind that wears me down, not them. And then to answer the second part of your question, which is, you know, you stop leading when you're becoming angry. I think that one, something that I appreciate in good leaders, which often you don't, I mean, I suppose with the big, with the biggest innovators in the world, or with the most, I think the, what you would call the geniuses of the world, I don't think they lead as much as they design, because they create. And then what, they are the center of the orbit, and then things around them just move. They're not trying to adjust for the orbit. The orbit is them. But that, unfortunately, doesn't work in, let's say, more conventional work, like legal work, or in, you know, in a hospital. There is not, you're not coming up with something cutting edge like Tesla, right? You're not creating something every day. You're really just trying to work in a system that is paralyzed or broken and trying to correct things. And I think within the context of that, when I'm angry or when I'm responsive or reactive, I end up then leaving the court and coming back to office. And then that kind of sets the tone for my mood with everyone in the day. And I'm quite mindful that is happening. And I don't believe it's effective, because it has happened with me in the past, where I've had people who I really respected, but who I worked for, who were extremely, you know, irritable and aggressive. And even though they were brilliant lawyers, they were absolutely brilliant, cutting edge lawyers, they were unable to manage people within the workplace. And there was always a sense of hostility, male dominance. You know, often I was the only female, and it felt really terrible. So that's something, you know, if someone's angry at you because of, if you have employees, they are going to sometimes ask you silly questions, or they are sometimes going to ask you questions that you've clarified already, but you need to be able to have the space to be able to keep explaining and, you know, expecting improvement. But if your cup is full all the time because you're experiencing so much grief every day, it's very difficult to expect to lead then, because you have nothing left to give. So that's why I tried to keep the cup slightly less full, maybe half full, so that I can take more from, you know, the people around me, which invariably you have to in an organization. It's not possible to insulate yourself from everyone's issues.
What do you do when you can feel your cup filling up too much? Where do you go? What do you do? Who do you talk to?
I think I've become, because of the nature of the work we do, it's very hard. You know, lots of rape cases, lots of abuse, lots of kidnapping of children. I think I'm quite cognizant as to when something is affecting me too much. And in that, when that happens, I usually, so one way to really just reduce the stress is to stop going to court appearances and to making someone else from my team go to court appearances, because that reduces 50% of the negative interactions, the aggression, pushing, you know, the courts are overcrowded. So that reduces 50%. And then I think I just try to build in like reading for leisure, reading poetry, going to the park for a walk. So I end up just trying to do more wholesome things for myself that I won't usually do in the week because work gets too hectic. Who do I talk to? My grandfather. He's worked in Pakistan as kind of, he's worked in a similar space to me. So I often just call him and vent, and he finds it hilarious, the things that, you know, men say to me, because he's like, why do you take this seriously? I'm like, it's really easier said than done because they are serious.
And he laughs himself. He uses his own medicine.
Yeah, he laughs himself and then he makes me laugh. And then, you know, he kind of is like, why are you bogging yourself down with these silly people? So
the other word you used was reactive. And I think that's really interesting too, isn't it? When another force forces you to become reactive, then they know they're winning, don't they? Because you become obsessed with them. They're setting the agenda. And the danger is that in your leading, you become very reactive, don't you?
I think there's a fine line between correcting someone's beliefs that you believe are wrong, and then also being able to know when it's not worthwhile to keep correcting someone else's beliefs. Because, I mean, ideally, you should not have to correct other people's beliefs. Like, one should be able to coexist with a difference of beliefs. But as we know, that's not the reality of the world. But yeah, it does end up, you do end up becoming that and being perceived as that. So I think it does require very often to zoom out and kind of take a few steps away. Because when, for example, every time we get a rape case and we have to go to court every day, day to day, and it's very hostile. So I kind of noticed it's a very hostile environment. And I noticed the change in myself. I noticed that I become more high strung. I'm a little less tolerant to mistakes. So if the same mistake is repeated 3 times, then I kind of am like, okay, now I've seen this 3 times. This mistake should not be happening anymore. But on a normal day, I think I would approach it with, again, some more humor if there was. So I think there are certain elements to it. It's not always bad, I think, to be sometimes stern, which I think was, you also started with this about overcompensating. And I think you then end up feeling guilty because you feel as if that when you are stern or when you do try to set boundaries, you're perhaps being too harsh because so many people have been harsh with you.
I remember you telling me that you always make sure that you compensate the women that you work with fairly.
Yeah.
Because you've experienced the opposite and observed the opposite. But I wonder, do you also compensate by sometimes not getting stern? And that doesn't work either, does it? Because you have to be stern sometimes.
It's like a pendulum, you know, swing between two sides. And it's really about finding that medium, which is a balance of both. But it's also impossible to be in extremely hostile environments and then continue to lead from a place of regulation and continue to lead from a place that's honest to you, because you're always in environments that are pushing you to different extremes within yourself. So I am cognizant that there will be, you know, ebbs and flows within that. It's about just, I suppose, being able to come back to your center or your gravity. And I do think that it has been, and I still, you know, I believe that you keep learning in life. There's no, you know, your growth is endless. And there is a sense of overcompensating in the sense of being, you know, if you expect someone to meet a deadline and they repeatedly have plans and they cannot meet it, you know, within office hours, then you expect them to put in that extra time. Which, by the way, is extremely in litigation in Pakistan, there are no hours. And I'm quite respectful of people's time. I don't make them work after 6 p.m., but occasionally you have to work if there's an urgent case. Someone's assaulted, someone's attacked. But I do feel a lot of pushback. I get a lot of responses from people saying, you know, we're going above and beyond. And I, you know, I have to clap back and say, well, you'd be doing that anywhere else. You were working. So why do you believe that because it's for me, it's above and beyond? You're doing the minimum required of this job. So, you know, I say work days are Monday to Friday, but court in Pakistan is also open on Saturday. So if there's a case, they have to go to court, attend the hearing, and then they're free after that. But then I often hear people saying back that we're working on Saturday, even though work is Monday to Friday. which I find to be humorous because in other law firms in Pakistan, they stipulate the workday as Monday to Saturday. So you're already getting a better deal when you're joining. And the occasional week where you have to go to work on Saturday, you are upset and pushing back, even though you know that I haven't fixed the case, the court has. So I don't think it's a fine balance. It's difficult because people have all kinds of issues all the time. But I definitely think when people push back more with the female leader than they do with a male leader.
Sometimes, you know, a new member of staff comes in and finds such a beautiful culture and such kindness and such understanding and compared to what they've seen before. And then you are stern. And somehow they think you're schizophrenic.
Yeah, they do. And then sometimes you feel that you actually are. So
that's true too.
That's kind of echoed back to you. So you kind of then say something, then you check yourself, then you, you know. It's kind of in some ways an unforgiving job, but at the same time, I think the kind of successes that we get through our cases, they're so meaningful that it kind of makes this navigation okay. At least within your own workspace, you can control the culture. You cannot control, but then again, when you're a litigator, your workspace extends to the court and extends. The court is probably like, you know, 92% male, more than that. So there's just a handful of women. And then again, you stand out. So it is a balance, but at least for now, I'm cognizant about the bitterness and the anger. I'm very cognizant. So I keep trying to set it off by when I'm getting too bitter or too angry. I try to take like a few days to just, you know, relax away from court, watch some Korean shows. Actually, I forgot to mention that.
Korean shows.
Yeah, because Korean shows just have like, they don't have any purpose. They kind of just keep going and going and going.
And they really do it for you.
I mean, they just take your mind off reality because nothing really happens in them. So,
Amina, this has been the most wonderful conversation. What you do is totally inspiring. Your honesty is incredibly inspiring. And then thinking that at the heart of some of this is Korean shows is just mind-boggling. So I'm going to leave it at that. You are a glorious changer of the world. Thank you.
That was a great start to 2025. I've picked up so many points. The two biggest ones to me are protect yourself in hostile environments. Know that they'll remain hostile whatever you do. I think that's really important. So push back, yes, but protect yourself too. And then you tell us that leading can become pendular if you don't get good at leading in hostile environments, because the hostility around you pushes you to the extremes within yourself. And good leading absolutely requires you to find your own center of gravity. Both of those points I shall sleep on and think on, and I'm incredibly grateful for. Thank you, Amina. Now, next week, we have another woman. Another woman in another place, in another context, but certainly still in a hostile environment. As you follow this series, collect the insights that'll work for you, because it will be really, there's going to be a lot of these episodes because there's so much to unpick. But in the meantime, I send you my love and hopes for 2025. Julia. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow our podcast channel or follow us on Instagram, or join the Women Emerging community on LinkedIn or through our website, womenemerging.org. That's womenemerging.org. There you can find out about the expeditions that we're currently running and how we can help if you decide to start an expedition yourself.